Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Patty James, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is now my pleasure to introduce Sarah Gottfried, MD. She's a New York Times best-selling author of The Hormone Cure. And actually, you have two books back there, but your bio says one. What's the title, Sarah, of your other book?
The Hormone Reset Diet.
After graduating from the Physician Scientist Training Program at Harvard Medical School and MIT, Dr. Gottfried completed her residency at the University of California in San Francisco. She's a board-certified gynecologist who teaches natural hormone balancing in her novel online program so women can lose weight, detoxify, and feel great. Dr. Gottfried lives in Berkeley, California, with her husband and two daughters. Visit her online at sarahgottfried.com. So, thank you, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to be with you, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me. I want to start first with a question for you. By a show of hands, how many of you have a low-stress life? Low-stress life. Raise your hand high and proud. Okay, so there's a few of you. Notice they're mostly sitting in the front row. And I'll be talking to you later about how it is you created that. And the rest of you have got a ton of content, and we're going to help you low-stress people today as well. So I'm going to be talking about three ways to upgrade your brain, your DNA, and your hormones as you get older. And this is a topic that's really near and dear to me. And I am reminded of a recent Time magazine article that had a baby on the cover that said this baby could live to 142 years. Does that seem outrageous?
No.
So the low-stress person says no, and the higher-stress people say yes, which is very interesting. We'll talk about that data a little later. So this is, you know, we're heading into this very interesting period of genetics and epigenetics. I think the next 10 to 20 years of medicine is going to be all about personalizing medical care and lifestyle management so that it's specific to you and your DNA. And that's what I want to talk about today. It's what I'm just so excited about, so passionate about, and I want to share some of those findings with you. And I want to start first with Jill. Jill could have been me in my mid-30s. So she's racing home from the office. She's got grocery bags. You'll notice a bottle of wine and some bread sticking out, you know, one lonely celery spear. And she is stressed. In fact, she's got a few other symptoms that go along with that. She works hard. She's gaining weight. She's got gut issues, bloating, maybe some irritable bowel syndrome. And she seems to find kind of rolling with the punches to be harder with age. She's also less stress resilient. And so I want to talk about Jill and how we could activate some of her stress resilient pathways with her lifestyle. So today, in terms of organizing the content, I want to talk about the problem of stress, and also some gender differences. So we've got men and women in the audience. If you got scared by my bio and you think I'm only going to talk about the chicks today, the truth is I've got a lot of content for the men, and we will be talking about that in some detail. I also want to talk about the why and how of three tools that you can implement right away that can help. So I've got a tool for the body, a tool for the environment, which addresses something called the exposome, a really interesting concept that we'll spend some time on, and a tool of the mind. And then we'll talk at the end about how to get more help if that's something that you want. So let's talk about the problem for a moment. We have this ancient wiring, the stress response system, that was designed to get us out of danger, especially if we had say a saber-toothed tiger chasing after us. And the problem is we still have that same wiring, but our stressors have changed. In fact, we create a lot of our stressors. Does anyone know what I'm talking about in terms of creating those stressors? Yes. We also have a very common problem of dysregulation around stress. Now, here's one of those gender differences. I'm a feminist, and it pains me to say this, but women are more vulnerable to stress than men. And we know this from the regulation of the control system for stress, which has a kind of a long, geeky name called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal thyroid gonadal axis, HPATG for short. Now, this system gets dysregulated much more easily in women, probably because we're more sensitive to the environment. And that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Now, men and women are different in how they respond to stress, but in terms of the way that we search for problems and threats in the environment, women are a little more sensitive. And in many ways, this makes sense. You know, the early studies looking at the fight or flight response were done in the 1930s by a guy named Walter Cannon. And he studied men. So he looked at this hypothalamic pituitary adrenal thyroid gonadal axis, and he saw that people went into fight or flight. Men did. And it was assumed that this also applies to women. And it wasn't actually until the 1980s that Shelley Taylor at UCLA found an alternate pathway, which is tend and befriend. And that's a system that women use to cope with stress more effectively. So we're going to talk about how to leverage that better as we move on. Another issue is that the prescriptions we have on offer are not necessarily the answer. And I was taught how to prescribe these things, antidepressants, sleeping pills, anxiety medications. I was taught, you know, how to give the risk benefits and alternatives and how to dose them, how to give all three in some cases. And yet these don't address the root cause, which is often a hypersensitive or hyper-responsive hypothalamic pituitary adrenal thyroid gonadal system. We also have cognitive limitations, which I want to talk about a little bit today. These are the ways that we're not quite as rational as we think when it comes to discerning threat and perceiving stress. And this can often get in the way. Here's a quote from one of my favorite stress experts, Robert Sapolsky, and I don't know if we can say it any better than him, so I'm going to read his quote. Insofar as we're smart enough to have invented this stuff and stupid enough to fall for it, we have the potential to be wise enough to keep this stuff in perspective. So I totally agree with this, and my hope for you is that when you leave today, you're a little wiser and you've got some tools in your back pocket, so that you can right-size your stress, and the next time I ask you if you have a low-stress life, you can raise your hand. So this is Jill's cortisol pattern. And I probably should warn you that I'm going to share some science with you and a few graphs, but I promise it won't be too boring. So this is Jill's cortisol pattern. Have any of you measured your cortisol, looked at your diurnal cortisol over the course of the day? So just a few of you have done that. So the idea here is that you can measure your cortisol at a few different times during the day. Typically what we do in a research setting and also in my medical practice for the past 25 years, you can measure first thing in the morning, before lunch, before dinner, and before you go to bed. So those are the four points that you can see on this graph. Now, normally you want to be between the blue lines, and you may not be able to see it in the back of the room, but there's kind of this downhill slope happening, like a ski slope, where you're highest in the morning, and then you have this nice gradual decrease over the course of the day. The problem is some people don't have that downhill ski slope. They have more of a flat curve, and that's what Jill has. So she's got a flat diurnal pattern. Diurnal is one of those fancy names that basically just means that you've got a pattern over the course of the day, a circadian rhythm. So high in the morning, lower at night, downhill slope in between. There was a very interesting study that got my attention called the Whitehall study. And this was a cohort of people who were followed for a really long period of time. So it was a group of 10,000 British civil servants. And these civil servants were super careful and attentive to filling out questionnaires over the period of time that they were followed. It was about two-thirds men, one-third women, and they had this remarkable 73% response rate. That's kind of amazing. We don't see that too often in American studies. And one of the things they found is that the people in the study who had a flat cortisol pattern, that was as bad for them as smoking in terms of predicting death. So we don't pay a lot of attention to your cortisol pattern. Most conventional doctors don't measure it. I wasn't taught to measure it. It's something that I did on my own, mostly because I had a hunch that my own cortisol was a wreck. And then I started to measure it in my patients, and I found that, about 90% of them had a problem. But here is a huge epidemiologic study showing that if you have a flat line with your cortisol, it's as if you're smoking in terms of your risk of mortality. That's pretty serious. So that should get all of us to pay attention, especially the conventional medical doctors, but that's something that doesn't happen so often. So now let's talk about another person. This is David. David is my husband. He's often one of my case studies. He's one of my favorite case studies, although he only does about 3% of what I recommend to him. I'm told by women who've been married a long time that's actually quite good. So David works really hard, like Jill does. He easily gains weight. I offer a detox online 4 times a year, and he does it every time and loses about 15 to 20 pounds. And it, you know, everybody hates him because he gets such amazing results. He's got some gut issues. He's finding this whole aging process to be difficult. He doesn't sleep as well as he used to. When he's got deadlines, he gets more revved up. The rev in his body increases. Does anyone know what I'm talking about with rev? Yeah. Rev is often cortisol. He's got more wear and tear. So David's an athlete. He played tackle football, bless him, for about 12 years, and so he's got a lot of injuries in his body. And he notices them more as he gets older. But he's very stress resilient. And so I want to put together Jill and David as we talk about this issue of stress, because Jill has some challenges to overcome. David has found some ways to manage stress, and it's interesting to kind of look at both a kind of a negative case and also a positive case to understand what they're doing differently. Now, with this flat cortisol pattern, I want to talk about this in the context of breast cancer. And I was really disturbed to see this report in April, maybe some of you saw this, that breast cancer cases in the U.S. are projected to rise by about 50% by the year 2030. So I find that stunning, and it makes me feel, as a physician scientist, that there's something that we're not addressing. What is it that we don't know? What is it that we're not looking at? What is it that we're not paying attention to? And I saw this study from Dr. Spiegel at Stanford that really got my attention. He looked at this diurnal cortisol pattern in breast cancer survivors. And he found in a series of 104 women with metastatic breast cancer that women with breast cancer have flatter diurnal cortisol patterns than normal. And the loss of that daily variation, the downhill ski slope, in cortisol predicts earlier mortality. So this presents an opportunity to intervene. And this is something that we need to understand better. So going back to the Whitehall study, I want to talk for a moment about how is it that you get a flat cortisol pattern? What are the different ways that can show up? Well, there's a few patterns that they identified in these 10,000 British civil servants. One pattern is that you wake up and your cortisol is just not as high. And I wanted to just kind of mention what that looks like. So you get up in the morning, you hit the snooze button. You don't want to get up. You start thinking, coffee, 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 because coffee raises your cortisol. And it can be very hard to kind of find that get up and go. And often people with low cortisol in the morning are the ones that are the most addicted to coffee. But then they get into this catch-22 where they're drinking the coffee to raise their cortisol, and then they notice that a cup doesn't quite do it, and so then they start going to Pete's and they get a stronger cup or maybe two, and they get into this situation where they're borrowing from their adrenal glands. It's like a high-interest loan that they're taking out against the organ reserve in their adrenals, which is where you make cortisol. So it can really cause problems over time. Another pattern is to have a high evening cortisol. Now, I've never had this personally. I'm kind of a high cortisol in the morning person. And if you want to know what that looks like, you can ask in our question and answer session. But people who have higher evening cortisol, they have a difficult time winding down. They often get a second wind. And the problem is that can be very seductive, right? Because when I started having kids, I now have a teenager and a 10-year-old. When I got a second wind at night, I felt so virtuous. I felt like, oh my gosh, the kids are asleep. I'm getting so much done. And then I would look at the clock and it would be midnight and I'd have to be up at 6 a.m. So that can be a real problem when you have difficulty winding down at night. This is associated in the Whitehall study with short sleep duration, not surprising, and also high sleep disturbance. Because if you're going to bed with high cortisol, you're more likely to wake up and have kind of problems with vigilance as you try to sleep. You perseverate on problems. Another pattern that they saw, which was interesting, is that people who had maternal separation during childhood had a flat cortisol pattern. And this is one of those epigenetic phenomena that we'll be talking more about in a moment, where a non-DNA change is made, in this case in your circadian rhythm, where you have a flat cortisol curve in response to a stressor, like being separated from your mother. Didn't seem to matter to be separated from your father, but maternal separation really mattered. So we're really talking with the diurnal cortisol curve about normal circadian rhythms. And I have to confess, when I was in medical school and I started studying circadian rhythms, I thought they were kind of boring. There just wasn't a lot of action. And then as I moved more toward gynecology and understanding hormones and then looking at hormones in both men and women, I got really interested in the circadian rhythm because the circadian pattern predicts every hormone release in your body. It's really important. So the circadian pattern is set in your suprachiasmic nucleus in your brain. It controls the hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal, thyroid, gonadal axis. And it's also controlled by the pineal gland, which is a walnut-sized gland in your brain that releases melatonin. So the biomarkers, the things that you can actually measure, are cortisol, such as the saliva level of your cortisol at 4 times during the day. You can also measure it in your urine or your blood, and your melatonin. So the hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal, thyroid, gonadal system, the reason why I keep talking about this is because it is the control system. And so a lot of people, when it comes to hormones, there's kind of this oversimplified way of looking at hormones. And I want to disavow all of you right now of that overly simplified view. The simple view is that you say, oh, well, you get older and your endocrine glands are not like a fine Bordeaux. They don't get better with time. In fact, they slow down and they sputter as you get older. And so why not just top them off as you get older? So as your ovaries start to decline, you can add a little estrogen, progesterone, maybe testosterone if you don't want to have sex with your husband. And men, you know, maybe you've got some low T and we'll just tank you up with some testosterone. Oh, there's some problems associated with that. So when it comes to hormones, we want to be more intelligent about working with the innate system of the body. And we want to work with these feedback loops. And this control system is a very important feedback loop. So it's not as simple as just, oh, low cortisol in the morning, let's add some cortisol. We want to think about some of the ways of modulating how your body makes these hormones. Are you with me? Great. The other important piece here is that not all the hormones are created equal. So the priority is listed in this control system. So your adrenals are the top priority. Your cortisol is the number one priority. Why? Because cortisol's job is to control your blood sugar, your blood pressure, modulate your immune system. It is essential to life. If you don't have cortisol, you will die. So cortisol is essential. Thyroid is a little less essential. If you're low in thyroid, well, you might have some weight gain, you might be more puffy, you might have some hair loss, and about 20% of people with depression have a slow thyroid. But it's not as essential to life as cortisol is. And then your gonads, your ovaries for women, your testes in men, they're considered an even lower priority than your thyroid and your adrenals. So the idea here is when you're correcting this control system, you want to focus on the cortisol first. It's called the cortisol unlock. And so I want to talk about some of the ways that you can do that. How does this slide look? I'm going to take a peek. Okay. Pretty much you can't read this. Let me just give you the point here. So for those of you on the podcast, welcome. I know you can't see the slides. And for those of you in the room who are looking at the slides, the idea in your adrenal glands, they're the cute little glands in your mid-back, right above your kidneys. The idea in your adrenal glands is that you make your sex hormones there, right? So you make cortisol, pregnenolone. Pregnenolone is kind of the mother hormone that makes all the other hormones. It's the one that makes your life feel really vivid, and it also helps you with your vision. Pregnenolone gets made into two different pathways. One pathway is toward DHEA and testosterone and estrogen. And we all make that, whether you're male or female. It's just a matter of amounts. So men make about 10 to 20 times the amount of testosterone as women do. And then on the other side, pregnenolone gets made into cortisol and progesterone. And if you're someone who makes a lot of cortisol, like I do in the morning, I wake up like this. Oh my gosh, what do I have to do today? What did I forget about? How are the kids? Who's driving them to school? That's how I usually wake up. I mean, I'm recovering, but that's my general pattern. So if you are someone who makes cortisol, 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 and you're kind of stuck in that pattern, you're going to make it at the expense of your other sex hormones. So when I was stuck in this pattern of making a lot of cortisol, I wasn't making much DHEA. I wasn't making much testosterone. In fact, you may have heard me joke that at that time, in my mid-30s, I would have preferred to mop the floor than have sex with my husband. So I had to address this cortisol problem. I had to do the cortisol unlock. And this is my reminder. I don't have a photo of myself during medical residency at UCSF when I had a lot of nights, needing to be in three places at once, like the ICU and a woman's needs a cesarean section and there's a woman with an ectopic pregnancy in the emergency room and you have to be in all three places at once. But I often felt like this, where I was pretty stressed and I think I habituated a pattern in my adrenal glands. And I say that because I wonder if you have had times in your life where you've habituated a pattern that maybe no longer serves you. So I did that when I was 28, and here I am now, 48, still trying to unravel this pattern. I practice functional medicine, which is a particular way of looking at the body. It's very systems-based. So I actually was in a PhD program in bioengineering when I dropped out to go to medical school. And I like to think of the body in this systems-based way. And when I'm listening to a patient, I'm really paying attention to three key things when it comes to their cortisol pattern. I'm listening for antecedents, triggers, and mediators, things that kind of modulate your risk of having a problem with your cortisol. And some of those things you can see here. So antecedents, kind of predisposing factors, genetic environmental issues include your prenatal programming. Was your mother stressed when you were pregnant? So I can tell you, I was born in 1967. Was anyone born in 67 or before? Awesome. There we go. Oh, I got more of you to raise your hand. Okay, good. So my mother grew up in the time of Twiggy. And she gained about 20 pounds when she was pregnant with me. Now, I got pregnant when I was 32, and I worked really hard to only gain 50 pounds. So I don't know how she only gained 20 pounds, but I imagine she restricted a bit. And we know that it puts these little paper clips on your DNA, what happened with your mother, even what happened with your grandmother. So I'll give you a quick example. There was this terrible ice storm that happened in Canada about 15, 17 years ago. And during this ice storm, it was super cold, and the power went out. People were huddled in their homes, trying to stay warm. They had about 3 weeks where they were freezing. Now, 15 years later, they looked at the women who were pregnant during this ice storm and looked at their children. And these children had little paper clips on their DNA in the places that control blood sugar and their risk of diabetes. And that's the sort of epigenetic programming that can happen. So if you struggle with your blood sugar, which is one of the consequences of having your cortisol be off, you want to be thinking about some of these antecedents, such as what your mother went through, even what your grandmother went through. Toxic exposure is another example of an antecedent. And mode of delivery. So vaginal birth is considered a positive stress, and cesarean section is considered a more negative stress. Triggering factors are things like maternal separation, which we mentioned in the Whitehall study, how your gut is functioning, taking birth control pills. Are there any women in the room who did not take birth control pills? I would like to know you. Oh, good. Again in the front row. What is it with the front row? So the birth control pill is very interesting. It makes your control system, your hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal, thyroid, gonadal axis, less flexible. And it can cause problems with your cortisol signaling. So the guys are starting to doze off. We'll get back to you in just a moment here. And then another triggering event can be pregnancy and perimenopause. And some of you may relate to this. I felt like I was doing pretty well until I hit about 35, and then I started to have symptoms of perimenopause. And, well, that just changed everything. You can ask me more about that if you want. The final piece I want to talk about here that can change your cortisol pattern and give you a flat curve includes sleep, your exposure to light, especially light at night, food, drink, and how you time it, and therein lies a solution, your perceived stress, and also what type of exercise that you get. And perceived stress is the important thing here. So remember, if we go back to David, my husband, he doesn't have very high perceived stress. So I raced over to his office before I drove on the bridge today to come here, and we were shooting some videos, and I was pissed off because he didn't have all the scripts done. And I was freaking out as if it was, you know, like DEFCON 5. And he was like, it's no big deal. Like, if we don't get the video done, we'll do it tomorrow. But my stress activation system makes it into a big deal. And that's the thing I have to constantly unlock. So what can you do to reset your cortisol patterns? Well, so let's talk about what can help you go from the flat line with your cortisol to a nice downhill ski slope again. So one is something called chrononutrition. I love this new lexicon. So chrononutrition is where you change the timing of the food that you eat. And one of the things that makes a difference is to eat carbs at night. Eating carbs at night resets your circadian rhythm and helps to change your cortisol in the morning. I'm not actually talking about pizza. I'm talking about sweet potatoes, you know, maybe some plantain soup, good slow carbs. That's what you want at night. They also help you sleep. Another thing you can do is phase shifting with melatonin. So let's talk about this for a minute. You know, I have a lot of patients who come to me and they've got a long list of supplements that they're taking. They've got a supplement graveyard back at their house. And, you know, they have a list of like 30 things. And one of them is melatonin. And I ask them how much they're taking and they dig through their purse and kind of come up with a bottle. And it's a whopping dose. It's about 3 milligrams. And this is an example of the innate intelligence of the body. You don't want to just slap on some massive dose of hormone to this super sensitive system. What is much smarter and what's proven to help you is to take a micro dose of melatonin. And let me explain. So normally what happens is your melatonin rises at night so that you sleep soundly. And if you take a whopping dose, like 3 milligrams right when you're going to sleep, your body is just going to stop making melatonin. It's going to give up because the feedback loop is going to say, we have too much. A much smarter way to do it is to give a microdose, like 0.3 milligrams of melatonin, 0.3 milligrams of melatonin. Take it 4 hours before you go to bed. So hopefully all of you are going to go to bed at 10 o'clock tonight. So that would mean about 6 p.m., you're a little late. So 0.3 milligrams of melatonin, and then what happens is as the melatonin starts to decrease in your blood, your system detects it and starts to make more melatonin so that you sleep well at night. That's an example of like a small stressor, a small input that then allows the innate intelligence of your body to step in. Got it? Okay. Bright light machines are also shown to help you reset your cortisol pattern. And there's some data to suggest that wearing glasses at night, amber-tinted glasses, blocking blue light, such as in your tablet or your laptop, can make a difference because we know that that reduces melatonin levels in your body. So Jill basically needs all of these things. It would help her sleep better. It would help improve her willpower. It would help her with self-control and the choices that she makes during the day so that she can start to compound these more virtuous choices that allow her to be more stress resilient. So the next tool is that it's hot to get hot. And I'm not sure what happened. For those of you that are looking at the slides, the font was much larger on my laptop at home. I know you can't read any of these, so I'm just going to make sure you don't miss anything. So that'll also help our podcasters. So this is very interesting to me. How many of you take saunas? Saunas. A sauna? We'll talk about that. That's what you do? Hot baths. Okay. I like hot baths too. Okay. So saunas, I've got some really interesting data for you. So if you want to live long and not just increase your lifespan, but increase your health span, like the amount of time you feel fantastic, take a regular sauna. And I want to show you the data on this. And this is comes from someone who grew up with a sauna in her home. So I, as a child, I had a sauna in my home. My father is Finnish, and he grew up in Minnesota and Indiana taking saunas on a regular basis. But our sauna at home, I wish I could tell you I had a sauna every single day for 20 minutes all through my childhood. I'm like, you know, an epigenetic poster child of saunas. But our sauna was actually filled with Christmas presents. So it didn't get a lot of use. Didn't get very hot. But what we need as we try to craft a health span that really serves us is molecular chaperones. So we want to activate these good genes and turn them on and keep them turned on and turn off the bad genes. And saunas do that. So I want to talk about the science of it. Saunas are a form of heat stress. And there's certain stressors that are really good for you. So racing in traffic to my husband's office today before I came to the Commonwealth Club, that was not the best stress. For my husband, it's more neutral because he's got a really fun car. And he catches up on the New York Times. I don't know how he does that while he's driving. That seems like distracted driving, but he's just like happy to drive. And I get freaked out by traffic. So I need these molecular chaperones. And there's certain forms of stress that are called hormesis that are really good for you, like getting hot in a dry sauna. Another example is going surfing, getting in that cold water. Now, I happen to have a gene that makes me stressed out when I'm cold, so I'm not a big one for the surfing, but I can do the sauna. So this year, there was a landmark article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The association between sauna bathing and fatal cardiovascular and all-cause mortality events. And I just want to share this with you, because this is one of those things that like you want to call five girlfriends and tell them about this. So they had 2,300 middle-aged men, aged 42 to 60, and they followed them for 21 years. Amazing. They found that the men who had saunas 4 to 7 times a week had a 50% less cardiovascular mortality. That's amazing. I think that's better than statins. 40% reduction in all-cause mortality, including cancer, including dementia and related diseases. That is amazing. So let's try to understand this. Like, what's going on with these sauna bathers? Well, we got to understand this concept of the exposome that I talked about at the beginning. And this is, if you learn nothing else today, I want you to understand the exposome. I know it sounds a little jargony, but bear with me for a moment here. So the exposome is basically the aggregate exposures that you have in your lifetime. Aggregate exposures from the environment. And what we believe, our latest understanding of genetics, is that 90% of disease is from your exposome, not your DNA. That's kind of stunning. 90%. So then it gives you this sacred opportunity to craft your lifestyle in a certain way so that you can modify some of those exposures that you have. So when it comes to your exposome, there's a couple of different ways to think about it. You can think about your external environment, the things that you're exposed to. I'm driving across the Bay Bridge, I'm exposed to some pollution, I've got some carbon monoxide, I probably have some endocrine disruptors, some flame retardants from my car seat, right? Flame retardants slow down the thyroid in about 12 different ways. So those are some of the toxins I'm exposed to. And they can come from stresses, they can come from lifestyle choices, they can come from infections, drugs, pollution. Those are all your external environment. But then when it comes to the exposome, you also want to think about what's happening internally. How do those external exposures then interact with your biology to change your body? And so the internal environment includes what happens with the flame retardant when it starts to affect my thyroid. What happens with inflammation and my gut flora? So I had a green smoothie on my way over here, so my gut flora is pretty happy. and also your pre-existing disease. If you have, for instance, all of us have little precancer cells running around our bloodstream. And depending on your exposures, such as your stressors, do you have a flat cortisol pattern? Some of those cancer cells can get triggered to grow. And so all of us have these little cancer cells all the time. And the trick is to turn off the bad genes, turn on the good genes. And then a third part of this is what I would call biomarkers. And these are things you can actually measure in your body related to your exposome. Now, it may take going to a functional medicine doctor to get some of these tests done, but it's things like your heavy metals, things like metabolic waste products, your hormones, your immune modulators, your persistent organic pollutants. Now, I measure these things pretty carefully in my body, and I can tell you, I recently had a high mercury and a high lead level, even though I'm someone who's very attentive to these things. And I learned that the number one exposure to lead for women is your lipstick. So at some point today, the women in the room, I want you to check your lipstick, because if it's conventional lipstick, if it's not organic, there's a good chance that it contains lead. The average woman eats about 10 pounds of lead over her lifetime from lipstick. That's a lot. So here's a Finnish sauna in Minnesota. And the idea with, I actually traveled to see relatives quite a bit in Minnesota. And what we would do is we would go to the sauna and we'd all be in there sweating, you know, for like 20 minutes. And then we'd go dive in the lake where it was freezing cold. And then we'd get back in the sauna. And this went on for most of the day. And this was entertainment in my father's family. This sauna is kind of a nice one. It's a little nicer than the saunas that I was in. But this is hormesis. This is a really good stressor for the body. So a couple of things about the sauna. You may wonder, well, I've got a hot tub. Does that work as well? Or I like really hot baths with Epsom salt. Is that going to be as good? Or a steam room? Or, you know, are those as good? And the problem is we don't have data on those. We have data on these fins. So we have our Finnish men that we followed for 21 years. We don't have data showing that you get the same benefit from other modalities of heat stress. But here's some of the parameters. In fact, my gym is open until 10 o'clock. So you might even be able to go get a sauna today, depending on what time your gym closes, or maybe you have one in your home. Take out the Christmas gifts and turn it on. So you want the sauna hot. And what they found in this study was that it was an average of 174 degrees Fahrenheit. That's pretty hot. And the duration that seemed to create an effect was 20 minutes or longer. They also used water that they would pour on the hot rocks. It would increase the humidity. And they also found that heart rate would increase to about 100 to 150 beats per minute. Now, that's very interesting because you can actually take people who have a hard time exercising, people, for instance, with heart failure, and put them in a sauna, and they get this exercise-like benefit of being in the sauna. So it's actually a medical intervention that we can do. So why is it that saunas help? Well, one, we're not really sure. But we've got some ideas about the mechanism, and I just want to share some of those. Could it be that it's just the heat? You know, is it activating certain genes, turning on certain good genes? Could it be that it's the relaxation? Because we've got so many problems associated with the stress response. Could it be that it's just increased leisure time? People who have saunas have more leisure time. Could it be camaraderie? We know that emotional connection is a really important part of cortisol patterning and stress response. Could it be that you activate the FOXO3? So I want to mention this one gene. This is one of the best longevity genes that we know about. Have you noticed that most genes sound like license plates? So FOXO3 is a particular gene that is consistently associated with longevity. In fact, we know that people who make more FOXO3, which gets turned on by having a sauna, they have three times the chance of living to age 100. So this is a good gene to activate. And I want to just tell you, I'm going to summarize what else Asana does so that we can get to tool number three. So here's, I'm going to summarize the data for you. So this is about 100 studies in less than a minute. So saunas are associated with reduced mortality and heart disease. We have that from the JAMA article. It also improves athletic performance. So this is for the guys in the room, especially you here in the first couple of rows, because you look really fit. So saunas actually improve your endurance. They reduce muscle atrophy, which is one of those very unfortunate things that happens as you get older. Has anyone noticed that? Yeah, so muscle atrophy along with increased fat mass, and saunas decrease that. We also know that they increase your plasma volume. They reduce your resting heart rate. They improve your heart rate variability. They generate a runner's high, so you get this endorphin opioid effect from saunas. And it boosts brain-derived neurotrophic factor, so you get neurogenesis, which is something we all want as we get older. And it increases your capacity for stress tolerance, which is what we want. So it's another stress shield. So I'm going to skip ahead to tool number three. And I want to talk about this last tool, tool of the mind, because I got really interested in the interactions of self-control, willpower, and stress. So I heard about a study by a professor by the name of Baumeister, and he found that people who have increased self-control have lower stress in their life. And that was a real surprise to me, because I think of people who have a lot of self-control as being kind of anal. So this really shifted my understanding of the role of self-control and willpower. And I realized that my understanding of willpower was totally wrong. So I want to share that with you. So I have a good friend named Allison. And she's shown here with my husband, David. Recently, they did a charity event where they did a back-to-back century. So they did three centuries in a row, Friday through Sunday. Now, I was taking the photo, and I was not on this bike ride because that didn't sound fun to me, but Allison went on it. And Allison is amazing. She's got three kids, she's a working mom, she's really busy, she's a little younger than me. She weighs about 120 pounds, she's super fit, she's weighed the same thing for, you know, like since high school. She doesn't even own a bathroom scale because she doesn't really need one. And I always thought of Allison as having more willpower than me. This is where I was wrong. So what I learned from the latest research is that willpower is more of a fuel tank. And the cool thing is, assuming that you get a good night's sleep and you eat a healthy breakfast, we all have the same amount of willpower first thing in the morning. Yay! That's such a cool thing. The question is, the problem comes in with how you spend your willpower over the course of the day. So there are certain things that can degrade your willpower, such as decision fatigue, such as saying yes when you want to say no, or saying no when you want to say yes. So there's certain things that drain your tank, and the trick is to conserve your willpower tank. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. Now, one of the landmark studies in this area was the marshmallow test. Have you heard of the marshmallow test? It was done at Stanford in the 1960s and 70s, and they tortured preschoolers by giving them a single marshmallow and saying, you can eat that one marshmallow now, or in 15 minutes you can have two marshmallows. And the interesting thing is they found that for the boys and girls who were able to wait the 15 minutes, who had self-control, they then had better stress resilience 20 years later. They had higher SAT scores. They earned more money. They had better relationships. They were better adjusted. So that was one of the early studies of self-control. And so I want to talk about this tool of increasing your willpower, conserving it, and some of the steps that can actually help you do this. So to conserve the tank, there's a way of systematizing your decisions each day. And this is another interesting one. I grew up with a father who always told me to sit up straight and stand up straight. So I want you all to sit up a little straighter. Did any of you get told that by your parents growing up? So it's actually a really good thing for your self-control, because it's this tiny little adjustment that you internalize, and it allows you to conserve your willpower. Another thing is keeping your room tidy or your office tidy. I never actually got that one down. Another thing to do, and this actually is drawing from some of the 12-step literature, is to pre-commit when you're sober. And I want to broaden this a little bit. The idea is that you commit to being sober if you have a sticky relationship with alcohol. I was taking a bar class yesterday, the Daily Method Interval, which is a grueling 45-minute high-intensity interval training class. And I was delighted because the teacher at the beginning did something very smart. She said, before we begin, I want you to set an intention. And I thought, oh, geez, here we go. And she said, I want you to decide now what you're going to say to yourself when you're miserable in 20 minutes. And that is the key. That is the key to conserving your willpower, to make a decision, pre-commit about what you're going to say to yourself when you're kind of hot-headed. Stabilize your blood sugar. It's amazing how many people have problems with their blood sugar, especially if you have issues with your cortisol. So I used to be a pre-diabetic just by virtue of my high cortisol in the morning. So I encourage you to get your blood sugar measured. The old school standards of anything from 70 to 99 for fasting blood glucose is no longer applicable, because half those people have insulin resistance. You want your fasting blood sugar to be between 70 and 85 milligrams per deciliter. 70 and 85 milligrams per deciliter. So stabilize your blood sugar, especially if your brain is running low on blood sugar. You're going to start making really bad decisions. Eat every 4 to 6 hours. And if you are a snacker who has to eat more often than every 4 hours, you probably have a blood sugar problem. Get it checked out. Another problem that makes you use up your tank is listening to your inner saboteur. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but does anyone have an inner saboteur? Yes. Okay. None of the men raised their hands. Interesting. I've got so much data I'm collecting tonight. So listening to your inner saboteur, especially if it's self-talk that doesn't serve you, can really drain your willpower. And then time compression, which is probably one of the greatest stressors that we have these days. So to wrap up, your stress shield is these three tools. Number one, reset your diurnal cortisol. You've got some ideas on how to do that. You can have a sweet potato tonight after your sauna. Number two, take a sauna. Do it four to seven times per week for at least 20 minutes. And then number three, conserve your willpower. So that's the end of our talk. If you want to learn more, I just wanted to mention we've got lots of free stuff at sarahgottfriedmd.com. You can head on over there and check it out. And I hope we have some good questions. Thank you. Thank you so much. Here's a question. If one does not have a thyroid and is dependent on pharma products, does the theory apply to the cortisol unlock mechanism? So this is a good question. So if you have, so let's go back to the control system. So you have this feedback loop, hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal, thyroid, gonadal axis. If you don't have a thyroid, you still have to unlock the cortisol first, because the cortisol is affecting your thyroid in important ways. Even if you're dependent on taking usually T4, so I'm going to geek out here for a moment. For those of you who take any thyroid medication, I won't make you raise your hands. Usually what you're taking is T4. T4 is the storage thyroid hormone that then has to be converted in the body into T3, which is active thyroid hormone. If you're a high cortisol person or a low cortisol person or a combination of two with a flat diurnal pattern, that will then make you not convert as well from T4 to T3. So some people end up taking a combination of T4 and T3 because they already know that they're lousy at converting, but it's still relevant, and then your gonads are also still part of this equation. A lot of women say to me, I had a neighbor that I met right after I published my first book, The Hormone Cure, and she is 58 years young, and she said to me, oh, The Hormone Cure, I don't need that, I'm past all that. And I said, honey, it's still relevant, because your hormones are still active even when your ovaries have gone into retirement. So you still make estrogen. In fact, you're even more likely to have estrogen make a backflip. You still make progesterone, probably not quite enough. It's one of the soothing hormones. You still make testosterone, less than what you made in your 20s and 30s, but it's still relevant. So you still want to do those things to prevent things like hormone-dependent breast cancer. And you can do that by modulating your hormones with the way that you eat, move, think, and supplement. You presented an association between sauna use and decreased incidence of cardiovascular disease. However, couldn't this be better explained by other factors like household income? Sauna owners may be atypical. So this is a really good question. I appreciate this one. It's sophisticated because it's asking about the quality of evidence. So in the study that I presented, the JAMA study, there's this group of Finnish men that were followed over time. So right away you can say, well, they didn't look at Finnish women. Does the same thing apply to women? We don't know. When you do a cohort study, they were prospective, so they followed these people over time, and they controlled for things like income. They still found an association with sauna use and decreased cardiovascular mortality. But the best evidence would be a randomized trial. So go through this thought experiment with me. So if you want to prove that the sauna caused a decreased mortality, you would have to randomize those Finnish people, half going to the sauna, half not, and then look at their risk of cardiovascular disease and death. And that would be the best quality of evidence. But as a sauna user, I can tell you that would be a very hard study to do, because people who like saunas aren't going to be, they don't want to be randomized to the don't take a sauna group. So this is one of those situations where the science doesn't quite match up to the quality of evidence that we would like to have. And it's the best that we know at this point. It's what's called association, not causation. But still, how bad is a sauna? And if it decreases mortality by 50% by association, I still think that's pretty good information. Levity. Okay. Does regular use of hair dye negatively impact the exposome? Oh, this is a good one. So I have to tell you, I'm not an expert at hair dye, but I've smelled it, and it smells kind of toxic to me. So I do think that there's a toxic effect on the exposome, but unfortunately I'm not an expert to the point where I could actually talk articulately about it. But if you want to give me your email, I can do my research and get you an answer. Next question. Okay, why are all the questions from the women? We want some men to ask some questions too.
Yeah, well, we can't tell the men's handwriting from women's handwriting.
David has not yet taken a sauna, even with all the athletic benefits associated with the sauna. I don't get it. Here's the question. My hormone cream, Estrace, has sodium lauryl sulfate in it. How bad is that? Sodium lauryl sulfate. So sodium lauryl sulfate is in a lot of different things. One of the most common places that you get exposed to it is shampoo. It makes things kind of sudsy and creamy. And so this is one of those endocrine disruptors that you may want to check at home. And that applies to the guys too. So take a look at your shampoo. If it's not organic, there's a good chance that it's got sodium lauryl sulfate in it. So what does sodium lauryl sulfate do? It's a fake estrogen that basically binds to the estrogen receptor in the body and stimulates it. The estrogen receptor is super promiscuous. There's a lot of things that attach to it, including sodium lauryl sulfate. In fact, there's about 700 chemicals that we get exposed to that can bind to the estrogen receptor. And for the guys who are starting to doze off, this is also important for you. Because as you get older, what happens for men is that testosterone starts to decline. It can make you feel grumpy. And estrogen starts to go up. That's the pattern that happens for men. And we have more estrogen pollution now than ever before in the history of the world. And one example of that is sodium lauryl sulfate. So for someone who's taking exogenous hormones, I would encourage you to formulate it in such a way that it doesn't have endocrine disruptors in it. Okay, we got a question from a dude. I'm going to sit up straighter. How do you accurately measure cortisol over time? Do you need to do a DNA profile with it? Oh, I love this question. So there's a lot embedded in this question. And there are a lot of different ways to measure your cortisol. So let's talk about that for a minute. How many of you have had your cortisol measured? Maybe you haven't had a diurnal pattern, which I asked about earlier. You've had it measured in your blood or your urine or your saliva. Okay. So you can measure it in your blood. And I started to do that in my practice pretty early on. I started with my own blood. And I found that I was about 3 times what I should have been. And then I found that most of the women in my practice had a cortisol that was about 3 times what it should have been. And that's what got my attention. So I tend to measure it in the blood because it's the universal language of conventional physicians. And I like to build bridges. But you can also measure it in your saliva, which in some ways is easier, especially if you're looking at a diurnal pattern. And that's what's done in most of the research studies. You can also measure it in your urine. And this is a evolving way to measure it, which I like a lot, because you can look at both your free cortisol, kind of the amount that is moving around in your body and is biologically active, but you can also look at your metabolized cortisol, how it's getting metabolized in the body. And if I just went over your head, just keep in mind, urine sometime in the future might be worthwhile. So there's different ways to measure it. You can also measure it in your hair. So I did a hair cortisol test about a year ago, and it's been shown to track with your risk of cardiovascular disease because you store cortisol in your hair. So those are 4 different ways that you can measure cortisol. I believe the most accurate is probably the blood, as long as you don't have a needle phobia and you don't have someone who's poking you like 17 times to get a vein, which is going to raise your cortisol. And urine, diurnal urine. So those are the 2 ways that I prefer to measure it. Now, what I like about this question is, I said at the beginning that we're heading toward this new era of medicine, personalized lifestyle medicine. And I think one of the most accurate ways to track yourself, to create a dashboard, is to do testing of your biomarkers, such as your blood or urine cortisol, together with your DNA. So those 2 can be very helpful. Either one on their own is not so informative. And so there's kind of this new cadre of physicians that are really looking at those 2 together, which I think is important. I'll give you a quick example. So when I was trying to unlock my cortisol, you may have noticed that I'm an obsessive tester, also known as a biohacker. And so I started checking my genetics about 10 years ago. And I found that I have a couple of genes that make me a total stress case. And, you know, not just one, but like 4 key genes that make me hyper-reactive. So that makes me actually a corporate warrior. Who knew? It makes me perform well under stress, but I get stressed pretty easily. And so I know this about myself, and when I put that together with the biomarker testing, it's very helpful. And then I can also kind of track the studies that talk about how to modulate the expression of those genes that make me a stress case.
Our thanks to Dr. Godfrey for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.